Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Yesterday marked the first anniversary of the death of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. The anniversary comes during 30 days of social unrest, which has claimed 18 lives. Hundreds have been wounded. Most of the news coming out of Venezuela show a divided country over not only the legacy of Chavez, but also the direction the country is taking in the midst of a political and economic crisis. So on today's Your Call, we're taking a look at the legacy of Hugo Chavez and the socioeconomic landscape in Venezuela. What is the significance of these protests? What do they mean exactly? Who's on the streets? And how are internal divisions shaping the country's future? Today we are joined by Carlos Martinez. He served in Venezuela as the program director for Global Exchange, where he coordinated dozens of delegations. He lived in Venezuela between 2009 and 2010. Carlos's articles have been published in Common Dreams, The Monthly Review Zine, and on VenezuelaAnalysis.com. And he's co-author of the book Venezuela Speaks, Voices from the Grassroots. And Carlos joins me here in studio. Hi, Carlos. Thanks for coming in.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me on.
We're also joined by Rory Carroll, The Guardian's U.S. West Coast correspondent. Rory was based in Caracas as The Guardian and Observer Latin America correspondent from 2006 to 2012. Rory is author of Comandante, Hugo Chavez's Venezuela, and he joins us from Los Angeles. Hi, Rory. Welcome back to the show. Well, let's start off with you, Carlos, because yesterday marked the first anniversary of President Chavez's death. He ruled Venezuela for 14 years, survived a coup in 2002. What would you say is the legacy of his presidency?
Well, of course, Chavez has had an unprecedented impact on Venezuela and Latin America in general, not to mention the entire world. Hugo Chavez really represented, I think, kind of a visionary attempt at transforming society, of challenging historical inequalities, and of challenging, the relationships between the historic ways in which the U.S. is related to Venezuela. And really coming out of an era dominated by what people call neoliberal economics, right, where the U.S. is basically prescribing the idea that in order for an economy to succeed, it needed to privatize public sectors, it needed to cut social services, a lot of things that we actually see here now. Really, Chavez challenged that entire notion, and did so very successfully. And of course, there are serious economic issues in Venezuela. But what is important, which often does not get reported, is that Venezuelan poverty declined by nearly 50% throughout his tenure, and extreme poverty by 70%. So, I mean, these are important legacies that often we don't hear about amidst this discussion of economic crisis.
Because when you do talk about the legacy, you can have people on just citing completely different facts about what's actually happening on the ground.
Sure.
So, I mean, in terms of the shape that Venezuela is in today, how would you characterize it?
Well, there's definite economic problems. Just actually in 2012, poverty dropped by 20%, which was one of the fastest drops in poverty in, I think, the entire region. However, inflation is a major issue in Venezuela. There's also been issues with the Bolivar currency and sort of the issues around currency controls, which were implemented after a coup attempt against Chavez to prevent capital flight from Venezuela. So the government is actually right now in a process of really changing a lot of these policies and issues, and also dealing with kind of local, national issues around questions of speculation. And for instance, a large chain in Venezuela called DACA, sort of parallel to Best Buy or something like that here, was found to be highly price gouging prices in all of their stores throughout the country, something like over 1,000% in price gouging. And so Venezuela has recently implemented price controls to try to limit that type of speculation happening right now. So there's a lot of experimentation happening, clearly a lot of issues that the government is trying to confront. I think there's a lot of talk of crisis, but yet and still, Venezuela, we need to remember, to just talk about one index, the United Nations Index of Human Development says that, Venezuela moved from 187 countries to 37 in terms of its human development. So, amidst all this, Venezuela is still investing heavily in social services, more so than most countries are at all, and is actually alleviated poverty. So there's problems, and there's also still the important legacy to remember of those benefits.
And that's Carlos Martinez. He served in Venezuela as the program director for Global Exchange, where he coordinated dozens of delegations. And Rory Carroll, are you on the line with us?
Yes, I lost you there for a while, but I'm back now.
Okay, yeah. Great. Thanks so much for joining us again, Rory. So, Rory, you were the Latin America correspondent based in Caracas from 2006 to 2012. How would you characterize the legacy of Hugo Chavez?
Largely one of waste. I think Hugo Chavez had a historic opportunity. I mean, he was a man of immense political talent. Who inherited a very dysfunctional country, and he was given a mandate by voters to change it and to make it better. And he had the great fortune to inherit also an oil boom, which was an extraordinary decade-long bonanza, and that the country really had never previously experienced wealth on this scale, and yet he squandered it. I mean, there is really the tragedy of Venezuela, that this, you know, man of so many talents and huge material resources at his disposal, and yet the policies that the government pursued really over those years largely squandered it. And we see it today. The consequences are writ large across Venezuela in terms of physical infrastructure, which is crumbling. I'm referring to the roads, the motorways. If you drive across Venezuela, you just see it. All the stalled projects in terms of supposed railways they were building, power plants which are wheezing to a halt, which is why we see blackouts, plunging cities into darkness regularly. The sheer just dilapidation, even they can just see superficially in government buildings. And not to mention the economy, one of the world's highest inflation rates, a currency that basically has lost all its value, and it's not even convertible really into any other currency in the world. Chronic shortages, which are getting worse. We have about a quarter of basic staple goods, almost impossible to come by. Now, I mean, when I was there just a few months ago, you just can't get milk for a lot of money. You can't get powdered milk, you can't get cream milk, liquid milk, and that's just one example. And you know, I could go on, but the point is that it was squandered, and these tensions and protests that we see in Venezuela today are symptomatic of this crisis.
Can you elaborate on that? You say that it was squandered. What happened to the oil revenue?
Well, as Carlos alluded to there, there was one of the biggest problems was currency controls. Now, this sounds kind of quite, to a lot of people who are not in Venezuela, kind of like a nerdy, geeky thing to get your head around, because people think, well, Venezuela, it's all about revolution or the dictatorship or liberty or whatever. But actually, a lot of the unfortunate fiasco that we're seeing today is a consequence of currency controls, which normally are, you know, should be kind of short-term emergency measure which governments need to take. But in the case of Hugo Chavez, you know, he put them in place during an emergency back in 2003, I think, and we still have them. Now, the effects on any economy of currency controls over such a sustained period of time are profound, widespread, and ultimately catastrophic. It completely distorts everything in the economy in terms of incentives, the way the economy basically works. When it gets to Venezuela, it doesn't work. And it creates a whole, so many distortions that creates. And that was really the biggest problem. But they compounded that by price controls, which have also managed to destroy, or at least to damage businesses. Because in a desperate attempt to cap inflation, which are the product of the printing presses of the government, running overtime, they've now punished businesses by trying to oblige them to lower their prices. And I remember when I was there, my butcher, the military came by and they were arresting butchers for having increased prices for selling meat and chicken, and these kind of periodic purges or intimidation campaigns against businesses. When really these price rises and inflation are just, again, symptomatic of completely, irrational and, frankly, at the end of it, almost insane government economic policies.
Carlos, what are your thoughts on Rory's comments that Chavez was given a mandate and he largely failed?
Well, it's hard to see how a drop in poverty by 50% is a squandering or a failure in the eyes of Rory or other journalists. And really, unfortunately, I will acknowledge that there are some problems in Venezuela's economy, which nobody denies. But the narrative about the crumbling Venezuela, the sky is falling narrative around Venezuela is absolutely nothing new. In fact, according to that narrative, Venezuela's economy should have crumbled about a decade ago. This is kind of the story that's consistently being shaped about Venezuela in international media, by the U.S. government as well, of course. In fact, I have to say that when I lived in Venezuela, that was always a really strange situation to live within when I would communicate, for instance, with my mother, who was paying attention to Univision or to, kind of the stations up here where, we were always hearing about the disasters of Venezuela and the shortages in food, which do exist to some degree, of course. And she would imagine that I wasn't eating anything that everybody, I lived on the west side of Caracas, which was known to be working class neighborhood, where you would imagine that to be the worst. None of that was happening, right? I mean, at least to the degree that, Rory and other people try to sensationalize it. So unfortunately, what we're seeing and kind of the message that's being sent is a whole lot of hyperbole that doesn't really speak to the realities of Venezuela. It actually says more about the views of the journalists themselves or the editorial line of the agencies that they work for. And it's sort of, I like to refer to it as sort of a junk food journalism, which it tries to create snappy, easy to swallow narratives, which kind of fit with our larger assumptions already about the entire region and specifically about Venezuela.
Well, if we take this point by point, what about the argument that there is so much oil, although the exports to the United States have gone down drastically over mm-hmm. the last couple decades, mm-hmm. but that oil revenue was largely squandered? And because of the massive amount of money raised by the oil, that there should have been so much, you should have seen this on the streets, and people like Rory say you don't.
And I would argue that you do. I mean, it's sort of an interesting thing, but I think, and this is sort of the problem that I see, is that the opposition continues to live in this alternate universe, unfortunately, which is sort of a reflection of their own prejudices, because oftentimes they don't actually see how people are living in poor communities, because unfortunately they don't actually go there. It's actually very scary for a lot of these people to even enter those communities, and so there's no perception and understanding of actually, why is this government still so popular? And of course, they have to follow that up with all types of conspiracy theory ideas and without any real legitimate evidence behind them. So, they have to use all these types of, excuses for why the government is still so popular. And until really the opposition or international media acknowledges this government is still heavily popular, and that's a legitimate thing, and this isn't just a bunch of people that are being paid off or zombies or dummies as the government would like to or as the media would like us to think, then we're not going to enter a real conversation about Venezuela.
Well, and Rory, this is a huge point of contention. I mean, when you read articles about what's happening in Venezuela, this comes up often. What do you think about the claim that Western journalists don't really paint a fair picture of what's happening in Venezuela?
I think it's a red herring, and I think the facts really do speak for themselves. And to rewind a bit, yes, there were very impressive and steep and dramatic and welcome falls in poverty, especially from 2004 to around 2008, but they largely kind of flattened out from 2008. And you would think, given the amount of revenues that the government had, poverty should have fallen by more, and certainly in a way that was more sustainable. And I think there's a big question mark over the statistics since 2009 onwards that really is poverty reduction really continued. I mean, as I said, there's no question over it between up until 2008, but since then, I think, there's a question mark over it, how real those statistics are. And I think when you look at the economy, for example, you go to Ciudad Guayana, which is the kind of industrial heartland of Venezuela. I went there several times, and these big factories, mostly that many of them were kind of expropriated or nationalized by the government. And these are big, rusting hulks. There's virtually nothing happening there. These factories have all become basically been gutted by the policies of the government, because either the government literally pulled the power plug on them, so the factories couldn't operate because there was no longer enough power in the country. So the government wanted to keep cities supplied because that's their electoral base. and so these factories simply couldn't function, or they couldn't import the necessary raw materials because, again, the exchange rate controls were so distorted, or else they couldn't export anything. And as a result of this, workers were completely either unemployed or underemployed. Mostly they were underemployed, they'd still be getting some sort of notional salary. And when they would try to go on strike to protest this, often they were put in jail or they were intimidated. I remember there was one guy, Ruben Gonzalez, and he'd been in jail for almost a year for protesting. The same thing if you go and go to both the agriculture and you see visit the cooperatives that the government tried to construct, which in some ways was a very good idea, but the execution, the application of these socialist agricultural cooperatives was so disastrous that you can see the effects. You go around Barinas, you go and see the fields, they're all kind of withered, people aren't growing anything, and you can see that's why Venezuela today is more dependent than ever on oil exports. I mean, something like 95% of its is dependent on oil, because the country itself basically doesn't hardly produce anything. Now, this is not a new story in Venezuela. I mean, this has always been a kind of weird, dysfunctional oil state. But under the policies of Hugo Chavez, kind of compounded these chronic ills that Venezuela has had. And so, you know, the country, unfortunately, is a basket case. And I think, you know, you really have to do kind of pirouettes to deny this. And you can see it. And so the question is, like, what the Western journalists have... I don't know. I mean, I just speak for myself. I'm not going to speak for anyone else. But my one point I would agree with Carlos is that elements of the opposition are out of touch, remain out of touch with the reality of being poor Venezuelan. And it is astonishing that, you know, certain elements of the opposition still haven't, the penny hasn't dropped after all these years. So there is, you know, there is a certain kind of out of touch problem there. So, you know, but also just one other thing I would talk about is subsidies. Again, this is an economy that's sort of been kind of led into this labyrinth of populism. I mean, forget kind of socialism or capitalism, really. I mean, the main problem here is populism. And so the fact that the government basically gives away gasoline, it's free in Venezuela. And that, when you think about that, that's just a disaster. And it's been free for years. And this is almost like a subsidy to the middle class, because they're the ones who have cars. But again, this creates a huge expense and drain on the government. And the government is terrified to even increase the price of gasoline because it's a politically explosive issue. And yet, it's one of the things that's killing the economy. And therein lies the tragedy, in that this is a country that's kind of addicted now to these kind of to subsidies and to these sort of economic controls, and the government is just terrified of loosening them because in the short term that would create a backlash, which would be even more pain. But by deferring this moment of economic rationality, and the country and the economy is getting ever deeper into dysfunction. And that's, unfortunately, I don't see in the short term any way out of that.
That is Rory Carroll, The Guardian's U.S. West Coast correspondent. He was based in Caracas as The Guardian's correspondent from 2006 to 2012. He is the author of Comandante, Hugo Chavez's Venezuela. We're also joined by Carlos Martinez. He served in Venezuela as the program director for Global Exchange, where he coordinated dozens of delegations. He lived in Venezuela between 2009 and 2010, and he's the co-author of Venezuela Speaks, Voices from the Grassroots. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. Yesterday marked the first anniversary of the death of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. What are your thoughts on his legacy? The anniversary comes during a month of social unrest, which has claimed 18 lives. Hundreds have been wounded. If you have any connections to Venezuela, if you're from there, if you have family there, what are you hearing about the protests on the ground? Who is involved? What are their demands? And what do you think this says about the future of Venezuela? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. So let's dive in and talk about what's happening on the ground. But first of all, Carlos, tell us a little bit about the current president, Nicolas Maduro. What do we need to know about him? And how does he really differ from Chavez?
Well, Maduro really came up as a union leader and came up through the ranks of his, of the union movement. And, you know, is kind of long, has been a longtime member of the of Chavez's Socialist Party in Venezuela. I think that he is, you know, trying to continue the policies of Hugo Chavez to the greatest degree possible. And, you know, and I think that there's still a need for Maduro to connect with the masses of Venezuelans in the way that Hugo Chavez did. That's not to say that this is necessarily a fault of Nicolas Maduro, but really the fact that Hugo Chavez himself embodied so much, and in fact, in many ways kind of embodied what, you know, he referred to as the Bolivarian Revolution. In some ways, those things became synonymous, Hugo Chavez and the revolution. And so Maduro is really trying to keep to catch up, I think, with this larger-than-life figure that, that Chavez really became, right? And which, of course, you know, we saw the evidence of the kind of love and outpouring of love for Chavez a year ago when he passed away. And we saw, you know, really, truly historic, I mean, lines of people waiting for hours and hours and coming from all over the country to actually see Chavez's, you know, tomb. So I think, you know, to come under the shadow of Hugo Chavez as a leader is a challenging thing. And I think that that partially explains the electoral outcomes of when Maduro was brought in, was elected president, which was a much slimmer margin between him and the opposition than when Chavez was elected just a few months prior to that, which Chavez won with a much larger margin, of course. So I think there, you know, in Venezuela, what we have seen historically is a kind of a personal connection that people had with Chavez, and actually a distrust that people had of all other government officials except for Chavez often. So, you know, Maduro's trying to come out from that to try to actually gain the trust of Venezuelans in this moment. I think he's done some important things recently, particularly around, and, you know, Rory argued that the price controls were a horrible negative policy. I think that those were actually very important in regaining the trust of the population in the face of incredible price gouging that people were seeing. And that was actually an incredibly popular a thing to do at that moment, particularly among consumers and, you know, working class Venezuelans, and to expose really what was happening, that this was not necessarily the fault of the government, but this was actually private businesses increasing their profit margins by 1,000% into ridiculous amounts, you know, of price gouging that were occurring and speculation and even hoarding of products. And so he exposed all this very close leading up into the December municipal elections, which were also, I think, an important victory for the, you know, United Socialist Party of Venezuela and their allies, where they won by about a 10% margin. And really what we're seeing now is coming out of the context of another electoral defeat for the opposition at the hands of the pro-government supporters. So, you know, it's interesting that right now it's sort of being presented as an opposition offensive or as a moment of strength. But really what we're seeing is, you know, kind of a division within the opposition of how do we respond to the fact that we're still, as Rory himself said, are not resonating with the majority of Venezuelans.
And hold that thought. We'll talk more about that. Who is the opposition, really? Who is on the streets? Today we're talking about Venezuela, a country with 30 million people. We are seeing about a month so far of protests on the streets. It's claimed 18 lives. Hundreds have been wounded at a time when people are marking the first anniversary of the death of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. So what are your thoughts on what's happening on the ground? Who are the people protesting? What are their demands? And what does this mean for the future of Venezuela? It's your call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on 91.7 FM KALW. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's a toll-free call, 866-798-8255. Or if you'd rather write, then call. You can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org, where you will also find all of the links related to today's program. Coming up at 11 o'clock, World Have Your Say from the BBC, here on KALW, San Francisco Local Public Radio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll be talking about media coverage of the massive amounts of money that super PACs are pouring into this year's political campaigns. They raised more than $140 million last year. They're expected to break records this year. We will also talk about lobbying that is out of control once again. We'll be joined by the nation's Lee Fang and the Huffington Post's Paul Blumenthal. That's tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are taking a look at the legacy of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, the death, first death, the anniversary of his death was yesterday. And we're also talking about the socioeconomic landscape there and the protests. How are internal divisions shaping the country's future? We're talking about this with Rory Carroll, the Guardian's U.S. West Coast correspondent. He was in Caracas from 2006 to 2010. He's the author of Comandante, Hugo Chavez's Venezuela. We're also joined by Carlos Martinez. He lived in Venezuela between 2009 and 2010. He served there as the program director for Global Exchange, where he coordinated dozens of delegations. He is the co-author of Venezuela Speaks, Voices from the Grassroots. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And we have a number of people on the line, so let's go to Roberto Lovato, who's been on the show before in Berkeley. Hi, Roberto. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Rose. Glad to be on the phone.
Glad to have you.
Happy to hear you got some good guests there. I just flew in from Venezuela, and I wrote a piece for Al Jazeera about the opposition. Who are they, and what are their divisions? They're hardly divided. And what struck me most about what I saw was I'd never seen so many high-fashion Nikes, sunscreen lotion, and people with really expensive dogs at a protest in my life. And so my question, and I think this speaks to the fact that the idea that they're quote-unquote out of touch, like Rory said, even that is hyperbole. There are no poor people in those marches. There were no black people. They are the whitest, richest protests I've ever seen in my life. And so my question is, given that, why hasn't the media, corporate media, really looked at who the protesters are? Would it have something to do with the fact that there's massive interest in Venezuelan oil and hundreds of millions of dollars that the U.S. has spent to, again, undermine the Venezuelan government? They've given hundreds of millions of dollars to Leopoldo López, to the students, Primera Justicia, and other organizations that are organizing these largely white in largely rich marches that are limited to rich neighborhoods.
And Roberto, what did people tell you? I mean, what were the conversations like on the streets?
Well, I spent most of my time with people on the at the protests in the right wing, and they're like, you know, I interviewed this one woman who was in this barricade with her very expensive shepherd kind of dog, and she would tell me how, you know, how they're living like Cuba at the same time that she was telling me that it's like $60 to get, you know, premium dog food for her dog. Okay, now, that's like, she didn't really talk about poor people and housing and education and real human needs of real poor people in a country and very brown and black and mixed people. She was talking about the suffering of the middle class, which is feeling the effects. And there are really people like this woman who really feel that they are being affected, who are feeling the effect of the crisis. But so are we here. So I'm hearing a lot of talk about middle class people being projected by the global media as if they speak for the poor majority, which is farcical at best.
Well, thank you for calling. That's Roberto Lovato. He wrote a piece for Al Jazeera English. He just got back from Venezuela. Rory, what are your thoughts on what Roberto said, that this protest is not really about the poor? The majority of the people he saw are wealthy.
No, that's a gross caricature from everything I've heard and people I've spoken to myself. Yes, a lot of the protests are directed or supported by wealthy people, but also we're talking about middle class and especially young people and students, not just in Caracas, but especially over in Táchira, over in western Venezuela and states that are far and away from these barricades where Roberto was. And there, that's where the action has been hottest. And certainly, there, these are not kind of, I would say, white people. I mean, firstly, in Venezuela, there are very, very few black people, Venezuelans, are almost all different shades of brown, and from kind of, you know, pale brown, whatever brown, but I mean it's, and you know, from the images I've seen on the TV and people I've been speaking to myself, it's more representative, I think, than this caricature of a woman with her sheepdog or whatever species, breed it was. And we have to remember why these protests started. I mean, it wasn't in Caracas, it was out in Thatcher Estate, where university students were upset because one of their fellow students was raped. And when the police didn't investigate and they protested, the police came in and beat up the protesters. Now, this is in a country where about 25,000 people are murdered per year and where about 97% of those murders go unpunished. So people are fed up, and rightly so, over the, you know, the fact that the social fabric in the country has basically been shredded through sheer mismanagement and incompetence over the years, and also these economic problems that we discussed earlier. And people have had enough, and that's why the middle class, many of those who can anyway, have already left. I mean, there's a diaspora. Now, this in Venezuela historically is a country of immigration. It's always attracted people, you know, from Europe and from the rest of Latin America would actually go to Venezuela to seek new lives and to build lives there. Now, for the first time in its history, really, it's become a country of emigration. And you go, people are, those who can, and this is especially the middle class, are stampeding for the exit. And that's why you see Venezuelan communities now springing up in Canada and Alaska and Spain. I mean, that has to tell you something. Now, as for the poor, they are the ones who are suffering the most, actually, because inflation, they're the poor in any country, in any society, are the most vulnerable to inflation, and also the most vulnerable to violent crime. Now, it's true, and I agree with Roberto, that the poor, in this case, have largely not joined the protest. And, I mean, for that reason, the opposition has to look at their own tactics and their own leadership and ask themselves, why is that? But I would also like to rewind this briefly and to finish on this, that what Carlos was talking about, the speculation and price gouging and hoarding, as if somehow Venezuela is a victim of a conspiracy, of some sort of economic conspiracy, perhaps or not, is this being directed by the CIA? And that's all basically completely ludicrous. Venezuela is suffering these economic convulsions as a direct result of disastrous government economic policies, which basically entail pumping the economy with money. The money supply is huge because they pump in all the oil money. They don't save any of it. They just flush the economy with cash. And when that isn't enough, because the whole system depends on this kind of ever more kind of populist model of spending, they borrow billions from China and basically mortgage the country's future to China, and they put even more money into the economy, just in a desperate attempt to also keep kind of shoring up popularity. And as a result of which, of course, the prices surge. And because of the distortions of exchange controls and price controls, shortages erupt, which means that, of course, people, ordinary people, do hoard. Because you happen to be toilet paper in the supermarket, you're going to buy as much as you possibly can because you think, well, maybe another 9 months before I see it again. And that also applies to a whole bunch of other products. So for Carlos or anyone else to suggest that somehow it's a good idea, as either legitimate or sensible, for the government to send troops into supermarkets and to order people to slash their prices and to seize inventory for companies, as the government did just before Christmas. It's insane. That's one of the reasons that people, you know, foreigners will not invest in Venezuela. That's one of the reasons that Venezuelan indigenous companies have all been out of business, and that's one of the reasons the country is even a basket case, and that's one of the reasons that we're seeing these protests.
Well, this does deserve a serious look, Carlos, just the economic issue, because when you talk about inflation, I mean, the poor obviously get hit the hardest, and there have been reports about the poor standing in long lines. There's a shortage of food in some areas, and they're really struggling over this issue. So what are your thoughts on that, and do you think that this could create resentment among the poor to where they also take to the streets?
Well, you know, it's interesting, this whole conversation about the poor going to the streets, this and that. I mean, you know, the poor in Venezuela have never flinched for a moment about going to the streets, right? I mean, historically, Venezuela was actually, you know, a land of uprising, right? All throughout what was, you know, allegedly the exceptional democracy of the 70s, 80s, 90s, when, you know, Venezuela was allegedly sort of this, you know, singular democratic state amidst other dictatorships. In fact, during that time, you know, people were going out the street quite often. In fact, I was talking to my friend Jaber yesterday, who grew up in La Guaira, which is grew up basically in a slum community. You know, his family built their own home. It's a city right along the coast, right next to the airport. And, you know, this is common knowledge among these people. He was talking about how he remembers, you know, they would be out in the streets in those communities in La Guaira because they didn't get water for 3 weeks.
Wow.
Right? I mean, these were very common things that people were out in the streets for. And anybody who's, you know, who experienced that, who lived in those areas, can talk to you about these things. And not to mention, I mean, the incredible amount of repression that was experienced during that time, which, you know, right now people talk about government repression. I mean, there is nothing comparable to what people experienced before Chavez came into power, in particular. And, you know, people often reference the Caracazo, which was the uprising in 1989 in response to privatization, and, you know, in response to all these economic measures that were supposed to help the Venezuelan economy grow, but really hurt the poor more than anything that I see happening now. People went out en masse to the streets and were repressed incredibly. Thousands of people were killed. There's still not a clear number of exactly how many, but the repression was powerful, and that memory of that repression is still very clear in people's minds. So, you know, so this whole conversation about, like, well, why aren't the poor in the streets? They were in the streets, and they were repressed, and now they're not, right? And so it's sort of like, well, it's a no-brainer, right? I mean, they've experienced a very different situation. They have water in their communities. They do have food. Maybe there's lines. Sometimes there are problems. Maybe there are some products that have been missing. But people are not going hungry in Venezuela. I can tell you that right now. From any reports, from anybody that lives in any communities, people that I've been in touch with myself over the past days and weeks, you know, things haven't, and certainly since the time that I've lived there, that's not happening. And when I lived there in 2009, 2010, that was the dominant narrative, that everybody was going hungry. And it certainly wasn't true then. It's not true now.
And Rory, I know we have to let you go soon. So final thoughts from you. Where do you see this going?
Well, firstly, I agree that people don't go hungry in Venezuela, and because it's a petrostate. There's always going to be money there. No matter how much they can screw up the economy, there will always be money. It's not, you know, Ethiopia. But the issue, though, is the fact that you have now people queuing up for 8-9 hours, like this week, just to try and get flour or basic goods. And I was living there up until 2012, and I'm a regular visitor. I was there just a few months ago, so I think my information is a bit more current than Carlos. And all the people are not starving, and I think they never will. The fact that just daily life has become such a grind. And in terms of the protests, the poor are on the streets. They've been on the streets for years in the last couple of years. There's a human rights advocacy group called Provea, and they canned these protests and demonstrations. And I remember they, off the top of my head, I think from around 2009, the number of annual protests surged to about 4,000. Wow. And that's been stayed steadily up until about up until 2011 and I think 2012. Now, these protests are all very small and quite fleeting. But if you just drive through Venezuela, I encounter them all the time. You come through a village or a town, and people come down, they block the motorway because they're upset, and they're upset because there's no milk in the stores. They're upset because there's been another power cut, or because the roads have crumbled and the town is cut off. And these protests are happening all the time. Now, the thing is, two things. The government is often able to kind of buy them off in the short term, because they will simply, as a petrostate, they can offer, you know, people promises, or they can try and send, you know, it's kind of like, you know, to alleviate the immediate grievance if they can. But the other thing is, the government, because it kind of dominates the media there, is able to kind of muffle these protests so they don't really echo much. And I remember being in one protest. I was stuck in a traffic jam basically for 2 days in a town called Morón. And there's nothing on the radio, on the local radio stations or in the local newspapers reporting these protests, because they were all either state-owned media outlets, or they were privately owned, but self-censorship meant that they did not carry news of these protests. So even, you know, and that's the reality. And so that's where the the poor are. And I was thinking of Morón, and I mean, a really graphic example that shows, illustrated just how far Venezuela has fallen, is in the same town of Morón. Recently, a cattle truck spilled off the road. I think it fell into one of those potholes I mentioned. And what happened is people came down from the town and they slaughtered the cattle on the motorway and they hauled away hunks of beef. Now, this was almost like a biblical scene of desperation and complete lawlessness and impunity. And that is such a symbolic image, that people coming down from the barrios and slaughtering these cattle on the highway and carrying it away. I mean, right there, that's unfortunately a big story of Venezuela today.
Well, Rory, I know we have to let you go, so thank you for joining us.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Thank you. That's Rory Carroll. He was based in Caracas as the Guardian's correspondent from 2006 to 2012. He's the author of Comandante, Hugo Chavez's Venezuela. And joining us for the rest of the hour is Carlos Martinez. He lived in Venezuela between 2009 and 2010. He's co-author of Venezuela Speaks, Voices from the Grassroots. Before we go to calls, Carlos, I know you wanted to respond.
Yeah, I mean, just one quick thing. You know, this accusation of, you know, people being bought off by the government is, I would firstly say, is incredibly insulting to, you know, people and to the poor, to the majority of Venezuelans who are certainly and would certainly not be happy with the caricature of them being bought off by the government somehow. There are, as Rory said, protests always happening. Often, I mean, the work that I did in Venezuela was to document the role of the social movements in Venezuela, which I see as really being the foundation of many of the advances that have been achieved over the last number of years, which Rory and a lot of other people don't like to recognize. But what I see in Venezuela really having happened with Chavez entering office is really truly a civil rights movement that's brought in historically marginalized sectors of society, Afro-Venezuelans, indigenous, the labor movement that was marginalized for years, really into the political fold. And those people are constantly organizing, placing pressure on the government to move things in the direction that they want to see the country go, while at the same time they're defending the government against, you know, the opposition and the right wing. So, you know, and this idea that they're just simply bought off somehow by, you know, the government, I find to be, you know, I'd like to see, first of all, the evidence for this, because I've never seen anybody provide that evidence. I just see it thrown around as a common trope about this populist state, this kind of tropicalist notion of what Venezuela is.
Well, let's hear from a few callers. Let's go to Max in Berkeley. Hi, Max. Thanks for holding.
Thank you. Well, thank you for organizing this. Thank you for taking my call. I get information on Venezuela from various sources. Very briefly, my mother's cousin migrated to Venezuela in the 1950s. And as Chavez came to power, she was strong supporter of Chavez. However, I spoke to her late last year, and her vision had changed completely. She's not upper-class Venezuelan or just a middle-class, lower-middle-class Venezuelan. She is a citizen now, but her view had changed, and it was very surprising. And I have read a lot. Thank to God I don't read just the American press. I read the French press, Le Monde Diplomatique. They have different views of Venezuela and Chavez. I remember a piece written by Garcia Marquez in Le Monde Diplomatique, his interviews with Chavez. I think it was in 98, just after he came to power. That was absolutely fascinating. I've always kept that in the back of my mind. But my question has to do with the economic situation mostly. And both guests did a very good job of presenting their views. But the economic situation is very serious. The rate of inflation is, in the 50s now.
Right.
And it's accelerating. Apparently, the government has a program to peg salaries to the inflation rate, but that won't work. That fuels inflation. That doesn't solve inflation. And the shortages are real. What realistically can the government do to deal with that? It's very, very serious. And I suspect it's eroding the government's popular base. And the fact that Maduro got only won with a margin of, 1.6% versus 12% that Chavez got previously a couple of months before is an indication that things are very bad for the government. And also, I'd like to add very quickly, there is criticism of the Chavismo movement from the left in Venezuela. I'll mention a couple of names, two of them. Maybe they don't have much credibility in some sectors, but I'll mention the fellow who, Petkov, who's behind Tal Cual, and also the former Minister of the Interior of Chavez, Michelina, who's resigned, I think, in 2002 because of disagreement on the direction, having to do with the direction of the movement. And also within the left, within the Marxist left in Venezuela, there is serious criticism of the government, the direction of the government. I'll stop here. I thank you for an excellent program, as usual, and I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Well, thank you for your excellent questions, as usual, Max. Thanks for calling. I'd like to throw that question to our next guest, Virginia Lopez. She's a freelance journalist who's been reporting for The Guardian from Caracas. Hi, Virginia. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. So you are reporting from Caracas. Would you first describe the economic situation in Venezuela?
Well, I think it's quite dire at the moment. It's a country that has been living through economic controls for over a decade, and that's led to all sorts of distortions. Price controls that breed hoarding as one of the most simple ones, but also has led to a complete decay of the productive apparatus in the country. This is an economy that relies heavily on imports. And with price controls, this just sort of spirals into all sorts of distortions and abuses.
What could the government do about this? What has the government said it will do about this?
They've spoken about several plans, and they've actually introduced a new rate under their organism that controls currency called SICAD. This new rate is basically a devaluation under the guise of a floating currency control. It's all quite new, and it all happened during the last 2 weeks of intense protests. So I don't think it's gotten the attention that one would have expected under normal circumstances. But I think that was probably a move towards liberalizing the economy.
And there seems to be a lot of conflicting information about who's really on the streets and what they're calling for. You're in Caracas. What are you seeing on the streets?
I think most of the protests in Caracas take place in middle-class neighborhoods. I've asked people in the streets why this is the case, and they, very blatantly have said, very honestly have said that it has to do with the fact that they feel safe protesting in places like Altamira, this upper middle-class neighborhood. In other neighborhoods, they probably would come under attack from, clearly pro-government supporters, but I think also, as we have seen, security bodies from the government. There has been a lot of intimidation and at times just blatant repression of these protests using, rubber bullets and tear gas. But there's also been accounts of motorizados, or, people on motorcycles that are armed. Also intimidating and shooting. It's now the death toll, I believe, is at 18.
Right.
I think, about what they're asking, it's like most of these events, it's snowballed. No, it began as students demanding safety, but then because it turned repressive, they also started demanding the freeing of Leopoldo López and other political prisoners. And then also, of course, mounting indignation over the fact that their right to protest was being violated. But I also think it's important to shed light on the fact that there's been other demands that seem to have been pushed aside somehow, and which I think are directly linked to the cause of these problems, and it has to do with the fact that a lot of the institutions are under government control and lack any independence. So some of these demands include you know, electing a controller. It's been now over a year since the country has had a controller. Also electing new authorities for the Electoral Council. For the most part, the Electoral Council is dominated by Chavez supporters or Chavistas, or, you know, supporters of Chavismo, when, you know, in any other country, these would have to be people that are independent in their role. Anyway, their period has expired. They've yet to be elected, and they haven't. So, I mean, these are just two of the other demands that are being made by the opposition and by people in the streets. I think also, other than the demands, there's just a need to show discontent towards insecurity. Venezuela is one of the three most dangerous countries in the world. Also, you know, shortages. I believe this has probably been said in the past in your program. But like I said, it's snowballed.
We have to do another show about this because we're almost out of time. And I'm so sorry we didn't get to all of your calls. But Carlos, what are your final thoughts? If you want to respond to Virginia or where mm-hmm. you think this is going. We have
sure.
about 30 seconds. I'm
yeah.
sorry.
Well, you know, just real quickly, you know, 50% inflation certainly is happening right now. But that is actually going back to the average rate of inflation throughout the entire 1990s, where inflation actually hit something like 99, 100%. This inflation is sort of a structural part of Venezuela's economy as a petroleum exporting state. And I think it's important to also recognize that piece.
And we should also next time talk about what it would take to diversify revenue.
Yeah.
Because what happens when you rely just on oil?
Sure. And right? I think there's been attempts and there needs to be more. So,
Carlos Martinez served in Venezuela as program director for Global Exchange. He lived there between 2009 and 2010. He's author of Venezuela Speaks, Voices from the Grassroots. And Virginia Lopez is a freelance journalist who's been reporting for The Guardian from Caracas. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of the massive amount of money that super PACs are pouring into this year's political campaigns. They raised more than $140 million last year and are expected to break records this year. We'll also talk about a Nation investigation about lobbying. We'll be joined by The Nation's Lee Fang and The Huffington Post's Paul Blumenthal. What did you see the best reporting this week? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.